Hello, welcome to Film Interrupted. My name's Jack.
My name's Martin.
My name's Nick.
This week we'll be discussing Over the Garden Wall, more of a mini-series than a film, but it appeared on a lot of people's end-of-year list on Letterboxd, and it caught my attention that way. That, and I've got some friends who are big into Cartoon Network and things like that. They're always trying to push stuff on me, so this is kind of a way for me to view some of the stuff that they've been recommending to me too. Before we get into that, how are you both doing? What have you been watching?
Hardly anything, in all honesty. The only film that I've watched in the past, like, 2 weeks has been the Blu-ray of Last of the Mohicans.
Wow.
Did you enjoy it?
It's fucking brilliant.
Yeah. Is it really?
It's not like a great movie in the sense that it's like captivating throughout. It's not like an amazing plot. It's got a lot of like kind of slow bits and lulls and so on, but it's like climactic, like chase action sequence.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good end action sequence. It really is. The music's amazing. It's really propulsive. It's just, we're chasing them down, chasing them, chasing them, chasing them, and then it ends with like a really badass fight. I was absolutely delighted with my purchase. I could really feel like adrenaline like going through me. Wow. As it was happening.
I remember Daniel Day-Lewis running and loading a musket in full sprint, and just how impressed I was with that and viewing it. Like, damn.
Yeah, it needs the music, because I watched the extras, and you see like Daniel Day-Lewis like wearing a pair of jeans, like training in some like sort of outdoorsman like course, and you're just like, oh my god, that's really brave that they put this on here, because he looks absolutely ridiculous. But when you get the music, then it's just like, yeah, sure, that's Hawkeye. Because it's got fond memories for me, because I think it's the only movie I ever saw in the cinema with my dad that my dad liked.
Oh, wow.
I think everything else was either, you know, he was just there out of like obligation, or we left because, you know, he wasn't going to stand for this.
It is quite a dadsy film, isn't it? My dad always recommended that film to me, but I never watched it. As you were saying it, what I was thinking of was the Kevin Costner one.
Dances with Wolves.
Yeah. I imagine that they're both, I've seen neither, I imagine they're both pretty similar in tone, kind of po-faced and a bit dry, but
like, got them in a 2 for £10 offer.
Did you get both?
Yeah.
Wow. See that? I can't imagine a more coherent double purchase.
I was pretty. I was like, for once, my Amazon recommendations know me. It wasn't just full of like, you know, Peppa Pig and potties and stuff. Yeah. You know. But yeah, it's not like a perfect film, but by God, for that, like, you know, final act, I'm completely in the zone with that movie and just entranced. It's phenomenal just for that alone. And well worth, you know, watching some slightly stilted acting in the start and so on. But yeah, that's my sole like movie experience of the last fortnight. It's just been fairly busy otherwise. And
is that not quite a long one though? Like, is that not a big chunk of time? Is it not really?
It's a couple hours. It's not like an epic, like, you know, 3 and a bit hour kind of thing.
Right.
It's just beautiful scenery, great music.
It's an epic in tone. Yeah.
Yeah, but the actual storyline is pretty simplistic, you know. It's just, you know, there's a party of, you know, it's the daughters of an English general. They're travelling, they get waylaid, and then they get rescued by Hawkeye and his companions. And there's some shenanigans with, you know, the British and the French, and, you know,
these are the bits I imagine myself tuning out of prior to having seen the film.
And there's some fighting, and there's lots of running, and some more running, and then some people being frustrated, and then someone gets burned alive, and then there's more running, and the running just gets awesomer and awesomer until someone gets like the shit knocked out of them with a giant sword.
Yeah, I'm interested.
A big kind of club sword kind of thing.
Interesting. Very interested. I'll check it out one day, but it's one of those that it's just easy to keep putting off, you know, that way. Like, if there was more of an inherent appeal to it, then I'd be right on board with watching it, but it just seems so stodgy to me. But I will give it a go on your recommendation.
I will press the Blu-ray into your hand and know that you can watch it because you got a PS3.
I do indeed,
and expect a full report.
Okay, I'll report back.
A joyful report of how amazing the end is.
Jack, you said you've had, before we started recording, you said you've had a week off.
Honestly, I mean, I've just been working a lot. I've been doing 12-hour days. I don't want to get into work talk, but we're going through what's called managerial restructuring. So I'm sure you can guess that's quite stressful. But what time I have had at home, I've just been reading because I'm just trying to like get the half hour in before I go to sleep. Despite that, I've been doing some viewing, like in, you know, in portions, like half hour there. Before, you know, Kiyomi left and before all the stuff happened at work, I was watching some movies with her. We watched Perfect Blue. That's an anime movie from 97. And it's by Satoshi Kon, something like that. The guy who made Paprika, he died really young, but he was a really promising anime filmmaker who was doing anime that wasn't anime by trope. It was anime by the fact it was an animated drawing. And you know, you can do things in that medium prior to CGI. You can do things in that medium you couldn't do with film. And he was made Perfect Blue, and it's essentially a stalker film. There's no sense of science fiction or fantasy in it. It's a thriller, you know, a drama thriller that was made in 1997. If they had made it in Hollywood, you know, in an English-spoken film, it would have worked really well. And it was decent with some plot holes, but it was just interesting to see what can be done in anime outside the usual tropes. And I quite enjoyed that, but I can't recommend it wholeheartedly. I got around to viewing The Immigrant because it appeared on a few people or respects once I get end-of-year lists. I'm a total whore for end-of-year lists. It's just the laziest way to find films, but if you find someone whose tastes you kind of agree with, it's just the easiest way. The Immigrant is a story.
I'm generally like astonished if there's anything in anyone's end of year lists that I've even seen. Like, you know, I'll get round to it in like 3 years, but I never really see anything current anymore. I'm way behind.
I use it as a way to put things on my radar, and like, you know, you both know me, so I've just got at any one time about a dozen lists of stuff I want to see categorised and subcategorised. It's just who I am. I can't help it. And The Immigrant was on two or three of those lists. It came on Netflix US, and it's the story of a woman immigrating to the USA and, you know, falls into the hands of a con man and then gets involved in a love triangle. It sounds schmaltzy, but the script was really good and all the acting was good. It's Jeremy Renner doing a really good performance. Joaquin Phoenix, who I am a big fan of, not necessarily the films he's in, but him as an actor, a phenomenal actor. And more so than both of them, Marion Cotillard is a phenomenal actress. So those are the three leads. Great scripts, good set design, but, and it's a big but, direction's just plodding, and the photography's ugly. So I can see why people liked it so much, but aesthetically, just a TV movie. You know, aesthetically a TV movie, but as far as the substance and everything, you know, all the actors and the script is very, very strong.
It's interesting. Like, I know the guy who made it. Is his name James Gray, I think his name?
Yeah. I haven't seen any of his other films, but I don't care to now.
I started watching one of them with Joaquin Phoenix as well. I think it was like a sort of relationship drama where he was like, it was maybe a police family or something like that, and the inner workings of the family relationship. And I would agree that just something about the direction just left me really cold. Like, it was very slow, very plodding, but not in a way that I enjoy, where I just felt like this director and my sensibilities just aren't aligned enough for me to get enough out of this film to make it worth the investment of sitting down and watching it.
Yeah.
And it sounds like that would be my reaction watching The Immigrant as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'd recommend it. Honestly, just the performances are enough for you to watch this. The performances and the script and just the development of the narrative is really good. It's just that it could have been total Oscar bait. You know, if it was beautiful, it would have swept boards everywhere. But it wasn't. It was just and I can't believe I'm saying this, but I'm coming around to the Spielberg and Tarantino school of things where digital's kind of ruined things. It just looks shitty. And that's not true of every digital film, but I've seen more and more recently, like, are you even trying? You know, I watched, this is something I don't want to talk about in depth because I'm incapable of talking about it in depth, but I watched Slavoj Zizek's The Perverse Guide to Ideology. Just the clips he was using of stuff like The Robe and The Sound of Music, and that was juxtaposed to, like, digital footage of him, and it's just seeing them side by side like that, you know, where he recreates the scene of a taxi driver to inhabit the scene as a philosopher, talking about what he thinks is the philosophy of taxi driver, with images of taxi driver, and you realise that, you know, this is a dying art. I mean, cinema, celluloid, and it's gone. I never thought I'd say that, but I'm coming round to that argument. So yeah, The Immigrant was ugly, but definitely a good film. I rewatched Superbad just because we wanted something fun to watch and I couldn't be bothered stressing myself out. Our friend was giving away a bunch of DVDs and we picked out Superbad for herself, and that was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. That was just, I mean, that was the era, I think, the Knocked Up came out, 40-Year-Old Virgin came out, and then that came out, and it was like a 1, 2, 3 of comedies, one year after another. They were just all really strong comedies, and so I really enjoyed rewatching that. I wanted to have a bitch about something really quickly. Possibly really quickly. We wanted to watch Godzilla, and we're willing to rent it. But there's no way... Yeah, I just wanted to see it. Just, I'm curious, you know? I was like, well, maybe it's good. So we tried to rent it from iTunes. Like, no, you have to buy it. It's like, what? It's brand new? I'm not buying it. I don't want to own it. I just want to see it. You know, I'll pay you like $5. I'll pay you $7. There's two of us here. I just don't want to own it. We couldn't rent it anywhere. And it's just the frustration. Like, do you want my fucking money or not? I'm just going to download it. Like, do you want my money?
So just give me an idea, Jack, about the difference between the cost of rental and the cost of purchase. So how much did they want for you to buy it?
I can't even remember. Let me just check it out right now. I think it was like $16, $17, and rental can range anywhere from $3 to $7. It's like, I'm not paying you that. I don't want to own it. I don't want it. I just want to see it. And then if I like it, then, you know, if it comes down in price, maybe then I'll buy it. But don't force my hand. Like, you know, once again, do you want my money or not?
I can't honestly remember ever, like, doing a digital, like, rental.
No, I actually have done once, and the reason I did it once was because I got a DVD from Love Film. What is the name of it? It's the one with Peter Sellers, and he plays the guy who's, he's got, like, a slight mental health issue.
Being there,
that's exactly it. And it cut off, like, the DVD, or the Blu-ray rather, was fine all the way up until the last 5 minutes, and then it stopped, and I was absolutely livid, and I knew I was going to have to tick that it was faulty, and they'd send me another copy of it, but I just wasn't prepared to go through the rigmarole of waiting for the disc to come through, and then having to rewatch it, you know, 2 days later or something. So I just jumped on YouTube and rented it from there, and just watched the last 5 minutes, and... possibly reduced my review by half a star as a result. But yeah, I never have that sort of impatience in me. Is it impatience? I don't know that it is. Like,
I just generally think that if I'm going to pay money for a movie, I want to own the movie and, like, you know, have it, like, in my collection. The idea of, like, you know, giving them, like, you know, £3-4 to let me watch it, you know, once, it doesn't really appeal to me.
But no, there is something different, though.
It kind of sticks in my craw that it's like, you know, or you can pay, you know, $3.99 for standard definition, or like £6 for HD. I'm just like, no one wants to watch the shitty one, so why are you even putting that up there, you know?
But see, if you think about, we talked about before in the Way We Watch Films episode, where we spent ages talking about video shops and how much we loved them. Like, the notion of rental from a video shop still is very appealing to me. I would hand over £3 or £4 to take a DVD or Blu-ray from the video shop to my house like that doesn't seem straight. I think it's the fact that all you're getting is a blob of data for your £4 that it makes it seem like the transaction just seems a little bit insincere, you know, that way. Like, this should be something that you can offer as part of a Netflix service or something like that. The fact that you're collecting physical media for your £4 or whatever makes a difference, and you don't begrudge it as much.
Yeah, if I felt that I had to watch a movie, I'm not like ideologically opposed to ever paying to rent a movie, but I just think, well, either I will download it for nothing, and if I like it enough, I'll come to own it legally anyway, or I'll, you know, be glad that I didn't spend my money on it, or I'll have access to it, like you say, through like Netflix or Amazon, which I'm already paying for, or like, you know, through the cable subscription. So I figure if I'm already paying for like three different ways to have movies anyway, and buying DVDs and Blu-rays and be able to steal them, why am I pretending that I need to rent this from you when I can easily have it, you know, before it's been released?
I've given you 3 out of 4 legitimate ways to own this film. Yeah, if you haven't crossed that hurdle, I'm going to steal it.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it's not insignificant. I mean, I must pay about, what, £80 a month or something for, like, you know, the combined, like, TV and on-demand stuff. The idea of paying something extra just as a notion, it doesn't make sense.
So, Jack, did you end up, I think you didn't end up buying Godzilla or renting Godzilla?
I didn't end up renting it or downloading it. I'm trying to avoid downloading, just not out of anything moral. It just feels like I already have so many options available to me, once again, through my free access to things. I have Netflix. We don't pay for it. It's my mother-in-law's. We get access to it. I have Amazon Prime. We don't pay for that. We have access through hers again. I have HBO Go. That's a friend's. They gave us that. So I don't mind spending money on renting a movie that I want to see. If it's, you know, say there's three of us in the room and it's $5, like, that's a steal. Let's just do it. You know, we can't go to the movies. We've got a kid. We've got a 7-month-year-old kid. So why not rent it? We rented the latest Planet of the Apes movie just because I was curious to see if it was good, and I enjoyed it. It was a strong movie. And I don't understand. I think Kumi was theorizing that Godzilla was probably bought up by some cable channel. Probably, you know, like a HBO like movie streaming exclusive to here. You can't get it anywhere else. So I'm not going to fucking subscribe to your cable channel to see a movie. Like, do you want me to pay for it or not? So I just got pissed off, and I can't remember what I did instead, but it infuriated me at the time. So I just wanted to get that off my chest. But one other thing really quickly. I meant to mention this a few episodes back, and I forgot to, and it's been nagging me since. But I rewatched Weird Science, the John Hughes movie.
Mm-hmm.
I remember really enjoying that as a teenager. Rewatching it now, really, really creepy. Like, you know, like, two teenage boys, social rejects, make Kelly LeBrock by hacking into a government database, and she just sort of spits out of her computer. I mean, that's creepy, okay? That's kind of wish fulfillment. But it's wish fulfillment upon wish fulfillment, where eventually the two boys end up meeting with girls their own age and they're in love with, and then the girls fall in love with them over like one line of dialogue. And it's just this sort of onerous, possessive, really sexist view of the world through a rampant teenage boy's point of view. That's not violent, but still really possessive, and like, oh, it's just so much weird, nasty subtext in it. Have you ever seen this recently? I mean, I doubt it. I don't think you can get out your way for it, but have you seen it recently?
I mean, I haven't seen it. I didn't see it when I was at the right age to see it. I maybe saw it in, like, my early 20s or something like that. And I remember it being decent, and I think all of John Hughes' films that I've seen that have a good reputation are pretty decent. I think this occupies a place where it's undeniably, like, wish fulfillment and a little bit creepy, but kind of, I mean, undeniable in its appeal in terms of if you've ever experienced the existence of a teenage boy.
Yeah, you know, I think if you're going to make a film about two teenage boys in that scenario, it's going to be creepy, and it would be really dishonest if it wasn't like weird and creepy, because teenage boys are fundamentally quite disturbing.
Yeah. It doesn't it distresses me in a good way. Like, I can totally recognise what you're saying is creepiness, but it's kind of a creepiness that is, if not relatable, certainly understandable from anyone who's survived their teen years.
Well, some movie I've got a relationship with, and that I did see at the right age. I must have seen this at 10 years old, and Kelly LeBrock holds a large part of my imagination still to this day. There's certain scenes from this movie, and those were creepy, but what I'm trying to say is that those aren't the creepiest part. The whole pitch is that, you know, she's too ideal, she intimidates us, we can't take it. But they're after these two popular girls at school who they end up being with through just lies about who they are and just this, you know, this really possessive way you can say, I love you. It's like, you don't even mean that. You just want a relationship. Like, oh, it was just really creepy. I can't stop thinking about it. I was watching it with my wife, like, this is strange. I can't get over this.
Yeah, I mean, if it's any of the subtleties of the film outside of the Kelly LeBrock thing, yeah, then I've got no idea about how creepy or otherwise it is.
I don't think it's a good movie to be watching when you've, you know, you've just, like, you know, had the birth of your first daughter and that kind of thing. So,
yeah. I mean, the difficult thing,
keep her away from anyone male. Yeah.
The difficulty with these films is that I suppose it happens as well with, I mean, does it happen with female characters in films if it's a female-led rom-com or something, that there's always, like, a trophy partner, and sometimes, and in this film, like, well, often they would subvert that, wouldn't they? And, like, they would think, you know, these are the trophy partners. You'll end up with the trophy partner, but the trophy partner will disappoint you, and you'll realise that this person who is off to the side is the person you should have been with all along. And that's not what Weird Science goes for, no. It actually goes for, this is the trophy partner, and the victory of the film is you getting to be with the trophy partner.
Exactly it. That's way more eloquently than I put it, but yes.
Wow, okay. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't remember, but it seems strange that someone with the kind of, I don't suppose John Hughes ever gets thought of as a particularly nuanced filmmaker in terms of the characters. I mean, does he? Everything I'm saying tonight, I'm completely second guessing, but I mean,
no, he's not known. But just think about, I don't know. I mean, how in any way is a Breakfast Club not just a series of, like, cliches and stereotypes, but people like it for that. And I'm not a big John Hughes fan. I think my favourite movie is Uncle Buck. But, I mean, I did. This was a film that I didn't even remember the plot. I just remembered Kelly LeBrock. Like, oh my God. And I saw it on, I was around, like,
sounds like you were the weird and creepy teenager.
Yeah. And I'm not, like, dude, I'm not even going to deny it. Not even going to deny it. Okay, very weird, very creepy teenager. But I got it just because it was sitting on a DVD shelf. I was around, like, my brother-in-law's house. I was like, oh my God, you own this? I'm just curious to see it again. And once again, it's just kind of like, yeah, as it's going back to me being a teenager, like, oh my God, I was so creepy. Like, oh my, well, how did I get satisfaction out of this movie?
Yeah, I think you're just, you know, projecting, you know, your own neuroses onto the movie. I don't think there's anything really wrong with the movie fundamentally. I think you're just weird. Yeah.
Was Kelly LeBrock iconic from anything else except this film, or was it really just Weird Science that she got her name in?
No, I mean, I think I was slightly too young to be aware of her. I know that she did, like, Playboy and that kind of thing, and that was pretty much what she did. Was okay. You know, she was pretty and she showed her breasts, and that's a good way to have, you know, a fairly lucrative career, mm-hmm, if you look like her. But yeah, I never really thought of her as being, you know, she never captured my imagination, put it that way.
Yeah. It's funny, I actually saw something once, and when you were saying there about being, you know, showing your breasts and being pretty and whatnot, I remember seeing an interview. I was intrigued because I'd heard that Morgan Freeman, Lawrence Fishburne's daughter was going into pornography. Have you heard about this?
No. I saw a news story thing on Dig about it. Yeah,
and there was an interview with her, and she was saying that, like, she wanted to do pornography because she wanted to springboard her career. She'd seen how successful the Paris Hilton sex tape had been once it got released, so she decided that she wanted to be as famous as Paris Hilton, so she wanted to go into porn. And it was just, like, the most misguided. I mean, I'm sure that Lawrence Fishburne is, how do you even begin to imagine how a dad feels when their daughter, as fathers of two daughters, Like, how do you even begin to rationalise a daughter's thinking that that's going to be the best way to progress their careers?
It's kind of a strange one, because, I mean, normally with porn, there's a kind of, you know, anonymity with it. No one really cares where people in porn come from or what they do so much, you know? It's just, they're just there. So, yeah, it's strange to have such a direct, like, public... Yeah. Well-known face to associate with,
you know, to intentionally go in there,
the person
to be known.
Who's like having sex on, you know, on video.
Yeah. Oh, so imagine doing like a Matrix like porn parody now.
Yeah, it's weird.
Poor girl. Well, I think once again we've gone wildly off subject.
Yeah,
that's what happens when you say you've just got a quick thing to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I could segue from that. Keeping on the sex theme to a film that I saw recently.
Why not? We're talking about, you know, animation on the Cartoon Network. clearly, it's an entirely...
Well, I mean, it's close to anime.
An entirely appropriate, like, intro.
Yeah. Have you guys heard of It Follows? It's a horror film that's from this year, I believe, or last year.
I've seen the title. I'm vaguely aware that it exists, but that's... the sum total of my knowledge. As with most things.
Did you have any awareness of it, Jack?
None.
It sort of caught my attention for being like a horror film that has an exciting premise, which is becoming rarer and rarer these days. The concept of it is that it begins with your traditional female protagonist who has sex with a guy, and in having sex with them, he transmits to her a sort of curse. Whereby someone is always going to be following her, and they could be anyone, they could look like anyone they like, but the bottom line is that there's always going to be someone walking directly towards her, and they'll always walk at the same pace. So in theory, you could drive to the other side of the country and be as far away from them as if they were just walking at the same pace behind you, but the bottom line is that they're always going to be walking towards you, and the only way that you're going to be able to avoid what happens when they eventually catch up with you is to have sex with someone else and pass it on to them so that they are now being followed. And it sounds like a strange premise, but it's one that is at least sort of invigorating in terms of, like, that's clearly a premise that no one's tried to tackle before.
So it's a swappable STD rather than a contagious one.
I mean, STDs, I mean, clearly that's exactly what the the analogy is.
But you can rid yourself of it by having more, like,
you
unprotected
can't,
you've
sex. Only got so much STD in you, so sex just gets the whole lot out of you.
Flush all those STDs out of you.
but, if that other person is to get killed by It Follows, then... you're the next one. Like, it kind of moves backwards to the person who passed on the disease.
Okay, so you want to have sex with another person and then maybe, like, try and set them up with another couple
exactly.
of people to...
You need to build a network.
Get a bit of distance.
And I think the film is decent. Like, I think I maybe overrated it when I first watched it because it is such a unique concept and it does occupy a sort of tone that I found quite appealing because it's kind of suburban based, and that's something that you don't see very often anymore in horror films. It's very common back in the 80s, and it does have a very heavily, like, heavy 80s influence. There's like the score is I'm trying to think if it is synth. It might not be synth, but it's certainly very in your face in the same way that even if it wasn't a tradition of the films of the time, it's just accepted as like 80s-ness that score would be quite in your face, and because of that there's maybe a slight distancing. I'm not sure how I feel about these films, particularly genre films that have come out with like a very heavy 80s influence. I'm thinking of like the Ty West films like House of the Devil and the film called The Guest last year, and this, it feels as though I would be more invigorated by filmmakers trying to pave their own way. I think it's maybe something that I just can't get perspective on because it's the here and now, but it's maybe a generational thing where, like, this generation is determined to be self-aware regardless of, you know, the cost in terms of culture, in terms of breeding your own personality as a culture. But I mean, I think it begins with, you know, people on Facebook taking photographs with the camera in the photo, and people wearing t-shirts that have very gaudy transfers to just highlight the t-shirtness of the t-shirt. You know what I mean? Where, like, films are very deliberately self-aware now, and they're very much, you know, drawing attention to the fact that this is a score, this is a tracking shot, this is a zoom. And for some reason it just leaves me a bit cold, because it's not quite...
Yeah, I think it's, in terms of style, it's got to a point where you need a kind of anti-Godard to step back and try and, like, you know, recreate layers of illusion.
I think
and,
so. Yeah. I completely agree. Where, like, yeah, the artifice needs to come back in. But I don't even think that's the biggest offence of the film. I think the film suffers from the fact that it can't really deliver on the excitement of its premise. So what happens when It Follows stops following and actually gets you isn't really as exciting as you'd hope, and that's maybe a little bit disappointing. But otherwise, I think it's a pretty interesting film. It's possibly a bit navel-gazy as well. There's actually, like, one character who's reading Dostoevsky's The Idiot and reads excerpts of it out loud. So that gives you an idea of a slight snobbishness that maybe should be.
No, that just proves it's a, you know, an immense intellect that's been featured.
Absolutely, yeah. It's not someone who's trying to seem intelligent.
No one would, like, you know, grasp at, you know, the best known novel of one of the best known Russian novelists of all time.
The most challenging novel that nobody's read but everyone's heard of.
Yeah. It's just the names, man. It's just the names.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, that was at least, like, I mean, I'm talking it down, but I'd recommend that, like, in terms of if you're a horror fan, you spend a lot of time watching recycled ideas, and to watch something that's at least original is invigorating.
I think if you've got a horror movie that, you know, even if the film doesn't deliver all you want it to, the premise is interesting enough that it gives you an imagine if, and you can talk about it with people you're watching it with, then that's a decent thing to gain from one. So yeah,
but see what you said in terms of, like, this is where I also think the film falls short, is that you were coming up with ideas that the film doesn't think to explore, and I was thinking them at the time as well. Like, shouldn't you think about building a network of people that
I'd like to see that, where they're, like, you know, they're going out to clubs and you're like, you know, the wingman of the last person you had sex with, try to, like, hook them up with other people to kind of, you know, build layers of interruption.
There's more interesting concepts coming from this than the filmmaker is really able to explore. Maybe it's just a budgetary thing. But, yeah, as I say, the premise promises a lot that it doesn't really follow through on. So.
I like the idea of seeing, like, an invoice for, like, ideas and a budget. We're very sorry, but we only had $250 for ideas, so we've ran out of ideas.
Do you know the film I was actually reminded of quite a bit? Did you guys ever see the Invisible Man, the thingy one? The what's his name? The James Whale version with what's the actor's name? Claude Rains as the Invisible Man.
No, I haven't seen it.
That's a film that's so prepared to go with the idea of someone being invisible and the difficulties that he's going to encounter and the things he needs to think about. Like, I believe that film explores the fact that he can't have dirt under his fingernails, because if he has dirt under his fingernails, you're going to see the dirt floating about, so you'll be able to spot him. Mm-hmm. They explore the idea that he can see through his own eyelids, because they're invisible too. So if he wants to sleep, he needs to have a mask on to be able to get to bed.
What about poo? Is poo invisible?
Yeah, if you eat something,
okay.
You sort of...
Why aren't you writing films, Martin? Because these are ideas that just don't get tackled.
John Carpenter tackled that with Chevy Chase and Memoirs of an Invisible Man, where you can see stuff being digested and then vomited.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's a very good point, yeah, because...
I'm glad to know some greater mind than mine has already covered this.
I think, though, because, I mean, you never truly excrete everything that's inside your bowels. Like, they talk about people who have red meat in their stomach for 20 years or something.
That's just, like, dietitian bullshit, trying to get you to spend money on having someone, like, sticking a hose up your butt.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
People
walk about with, like, 15 pounds of compacted crap in their colons. they don't. It doesn't happen.
You say that. I once saw there was one of these programs where they give, what was it called again? They give like a geek a makeover and then send them to some sort of dance or something to be like the belle of the ball. But there was a guy who was trying to lose weight. He had to lose like 3 stone, say, and he'd lost a stone, or 2 stone rather. And they said, right, well, you haven't met your targets, so we're going to give you a colonic. And they pulled out like £16 worth of stuff just during the colonic irrigation.
It's like mostly like water and stuff like
that. Is it really?
Did they actually pull it out? Just the way you say it, pull it out.
Like, well, as I understand it, it's...
But yeah, I mean, your intestines are, you know, that osmosis will occur. You can like move water, you know, out through your intestines to absorb it into your body, so you can draw water, you know, out of it as well. So if you have a diuretic like coffee or something, then they can use that, and that will, you know, basically withdraw water from the body.
Yeah.
And that gives you like the kind of the false effect of losing weight from it, but you're just a bit dehydrated, really.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it's just like a need for replenishment. Like, you think he would have gained weight after restoring his natural body water levels?
It's just a load of shite.
Okay. The scales don't lie, Martin. This bloke was, you know, the swan.
The scales do lie. They do. At one time, I was in a big weight loss thing. Obviously, that's fallen by the wayside substantially in recent years. And I was disappointed with how much weight I'd lost. So I took a shit and I put on 1 pound. Now, if the scales don't lie, how did that happen? Tell me that.
Oh, something clearly crawled up the toilet and you've been possessed.
I don't put that in my head.
Oh, that's funny.
Right, so once again, dramatically off target. This is a running theme. This should be like, I mean, it's film interrupted by going dramatically off topic. Is really, we should clarify that. Let's just get on it. This was my recommendation. Cartoon Network miniseries, the first miniseries I've done with an arc from one episode to another. 10-minute episodes, maybe just under a 2-hour movie, if you want to call it that. I was curious about it. I recommend it to you. What were your first thoughts on being recommended a cartoon miniseries as viewing?
I'm going to use that pause to let Martin talk about this while I run to the loo, and then I'll delete this part of the chat. So, Martin, feel free to talk. I'll be back soon.
It's a strange dynamic to, like, you know, have an intro and then, like, okay. Let's...
I was waiting for a suitable pause, but
there are bathroom scales as well, if you want to check.
Okay.
I feel more self-conscious being in the cupboard alone and talking about things than I do. Oh, I miss my cupboard friend.
You can hold back. I mean, if you get some repartee going between you. Or we could just insult him randomly for like 2-3 minutes. And when he comes back and listens to the recording, he'll have the knowledge of actually don't like him. And we've just been tagging him on for years.
Yeah, that's pretty cruel, really.
That is pretty cruel.
I don't know. My first thoughts on like watching it were, I wish I'd had a better idea for this podcast, but I came up dry with like anything that was new. All the other stuff we've got planned is kind of long term, and I didn't have something that was kind of like snappy, one episode, just get it watched and out there. It was all right. I mean, I don't really get why adults should be watching it. I wasn't really sure what the audience was intended to be. It's a bit old for little kids. I don't think it's really, you know, sort of scary enough or dramatic enough for, you know, for teenagers or that kind of thing. It seems like a kind of strange, kind of comfortable, like kind of stoner early 20s kind of demographic they're going for. But yeah, I was a bit underwhelmed, really. Considering I watched like 10 episodes of it, I think I enjoyed maybe a couple of moments out of it, a couple of things that were just good, like kind of, you know, puns. But yeah, on the whole, I was left pretty underwhelmed.
Yeah, I mean, it was recommended to me as so many animated shows are via friends who are 20-something stoners. So your definition of the crowd of 20-something stoners, I think, is spot on. But I get what you mean. It's too creepy and dark for really young kids, but there's not enough there for an adult. But
I mean, I started watching it. I watched like the first episode that you'd shared, and I was just sitting with it on, and Nathan was around, and Nathan's, you know, coming up for 3 years old. And it was pretty apparent after like the scene where Greg is in the barrel in the first episode, and that dog thing like leaps, you know, onto the barrel, and there's like the huge eyes and it's snarling and everything, that okay, this isn't the thing that little kids are going to be around for. So that was nixed. And I mean, I trying to be positive about it, I think like the background, like the drawing is beautiful. I think they create really lovely scenery in it. The character animation is kind of simplistic, it's like folksy anime. But yeah, I don't really have the interest in the genre or the vocabulary, the depth of knowledge about other animation styles, and you know what this scene references and what this like style references to get the most out of it. It felt like I was just watching something that wasn't made for me and wasn't really trying to attract a wide audience. It was just, this is a comfy kind of, I don't have anything better to do this week, so I'll get high and watch this kind of, you know, target.
Yeah, I mean, I was saying there about the animation, and I was a bit worried looking at stills of it that it was going to look atrocious. Like, to me, it looked like the kind of, not even like good anime, but just like really terrible anime, like you might find, you know, again in the video shop, where it would be like, you could almost imagine the work character being almost like a really shit Pinocchio. Like, with a really, you know, crap conical hat, and just, like, the most basic animation, where you're just like, oh, okay, so this is just factored out to some fucking anime company, yeah. And this is what they come back with, you know?
Yeah, well, I guess the talk of colonics and stuff, I would watch shit Pinocchio. And don't tell a lie, your shit will get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Do you know, I swear to God, I was once, when I was a kid, I think it was the last pantomime I ever went to with my parents, and I must have been like 12 or something, and it was the Crankies, right? And it was wee Jimmy Cranky as Pinocchio, clearly, and the nose would obviously get bigger, but I swear, on the last remnants of my family's legacy, that she had a rubber cock on her nose that would get bigger, bell end and all, throughout the course, whenever she told a lie. And it was atrocious. Like, literally, I was at the Pavilion, so you know the type of crowd that they're attracting. But we were in there, and my family were just aghast. And I was like, what?
I mean,
Holy Christ.
I mean, the Crankies were a really peculiar set up from the start. I mean, if anyone's listening to this and wondering what on earth they are, the Crankies were like a kind of kids quasi comedy double act, and it was a married couple. It was a man and a woman, a very short woman, and in the Crankies realm, the man was the dad, and his wife played his son, little Jimmy. As a like a wee like kind of pug faced ugly schoolboy, and they had TV shows and, you know, did pantomime and that kind of thing. No one really liked them very much, but they managed to be on TV for quite a while, and then they got some secondary fame after it was revealed that they were, like, you know, mad cocaine snorting, you know, swingers in the Daily Record and stuff.
Were they
like that?
Really?
Wow. Yeah, no, they did some dirty stuff.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, as can be vouched by the pantomime performance.
That chimes in very well with your your anecdote. So I would not doubt the veracity of that for one second.
Nick,
they clearly used dildos as props in pantomime.
Yeah.
We've yet to discuss an animation together that you haven't called horrendous looking.
See, this is the thing. Like, I was worried that this would look horrendous, but as it started, I realised again that a lot of what I don't like about anime is the stasis of it. It's the fact that it looks so still, and you just have, like, maybe a character's mouth moving while the rest of their body stands there inanimately. But this film doesn't really have that. If anything, I mean, you could accuse it of maybe looking a bit like Java animation or something.
Can you call
like
it a film?
Sorry?
Can you call it a film?
This? Yeah. I don't know. I know Jack logged it, and I was raising an eyebrow at that, but I didn't want to bring that up and embarrass him on the podcast.
When you're logging it, you are of course referring to Letterboxd, the omnipresent.
I am referring to Letterboxd.
Well, it's because it was on Letterboxd. Someone saw fit to log it, and Letterboxd are tight arse motherfuckers about you listing anything that they don't consider a film. So, for example, something like True Detective, which is, you know, an open and closed narrative arc with whatever sequel is going to come along is going to be completely unrelated to the first narrative. They don't consider that. So it was there, so I just logged it, you know? What's the big deal?
Yeah, no, it's understandable, yeah. But I think it's just the runtime of it kind of works.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't know. I don't know how it would flow. Did you just watch it in one sitting?
I watched like the first two episodes, and then I watched like 3 to 10 in one go.
Right.
Just out of necessity to get it all watched.
Did the chapter thing kind of work for you? Did it feel as if you were watching things that would be better spaced apart, or
if it was a film?
I wouldn't have been like, you know, waiting to, you know, to have. I mean, when it was broadcast, was it what a few episodes a night or something like that? Because I didn't think
night,
it had
yeah.
enough. It doesn't have a strong enough like drive in terms of the drama of it or the story to really like make me want to see the next. It's quite loose. It's not a propulsive story. It's just, oh, there's boys and they're lost and it's kind of weird and whimsical and kind of old timey Americana, and stuff will happen and there'll be some confusing things and, you know, family relationships will grow and work will stop being such a useless brother. But I never thought, like, oh, I really want to see what happens in the next one. And then when I got to the last two, I felt kind of let down by the reveal of, you know, what actually brought them into this kind of fantasy world. So
I was let down by that too. Well, let me talk about the structure first of all. It doesn't work as a film. It could have, but it'd be like a half hour shorter, and it'd be a short film of about 50 minutes. They'd have to cut out a bunch of characters and done segues rather than different chapters. So that would have worked for me. But I quite liked the whimsical. I quite liked the tone of it. I liked all the foreshadowing. I liked the fact that it implied things that doesn't necessarily make sense. You know, I liked the use of the black turtles and the fact that they never really were explained. And that was quite. I don't know why I liked that, but I did. I was a little disappointed with the fact about how they ended up in the unknown. You know, this magical land, but not to the point it ruined it for me. I really enjoyed the beast, the opera singing, you know, shadow beast, and the whole legacy around him and how he exists. I thought it was really good fun. Oh, I enjoyed it, but I'm not in a rush to watch it again.
I think I maybe liked it a bit more than both of you guys. Like, I thought it was really fun, and I was always intrigued. Like, even if the narrative globally wasn't propelling me forward, just the thought that each self-contained narrative would be good enough to engage me for the full 10 minutes, which obviously isn't a long time to capture someone's attention, was enough to keep me going. I think it helps when I think about something like, do you guys watch Adventure Time at all?
I do.
No.
You do? I like a lot of what Adventure Time does. I think it's very, very funny. But when it's not being funny, it maybe loses my attention a little bit, because you've got your expectations set so high about the level of comedy that's in it. There isn't really enough of a narrative focus in Adventure Time to really hold your attention through the moments that aren't overtly comedic. This film, I think, places a much bigger emphasis on narrative, and each one of the little segments feels very satisfying and often very surprising in terms of little self-contained narratives. I'm thinking of like the best episodes being like the pumpkin episode, mm-hmm. and the episode with the thingy, the bell, the ringing of the bell compels you, and stuff like that. Like these episodes are the strongest because they are constantly surprising, and even some of the weaker episodes are always surprising, like the school teacher episode and the episode in the haunted house. Those two maybe aren't the strongest episodes, but they have enough of an inherent appeal to keep you watching from beginning to end and maybe not feeling like you're wasting your time. I think maybe if there was one criticism is that it kind of swaps out the overt comedy of Adventure Time and replaces it with a sense of, if not horror, certainly trippiness, and you're always anticipating the kind of freaky outiness that is going to come, and when it doesn't, you're maybe left with a slight letdown. And it's maybe just a substitution for one or the other. But I really like how they handled comedy in the series, just, again, with reference to Adventure Time, because it isn't always hilarious, but it's constantly... It's kind of numbing in its comedy, because it's constantly pithy and witty and smart and funny enough that you're kind of lulled into this kind of hypnotic thing where it just feels a bit strange that everyone's joking and consistently funny throughout the whole thing, and it kind of paves the way for the kind of freakier visuals that you're going to come into.
Yeah, I mean, humour is a pretty divisive and varied subject, but I laughed once the whole thing, and you know, it justified the existence of, you know, the unexplained black turtles just for the phrase, you know, we're here to burgle your turts.
Yeah, see, I knew it. When I walked in, I said to Lauren, I was talking to Lauren, your wife, briefly.
And she's my wife?
Yeah, she's your wife. just to clarify, but yeah, I was talking to Lauren and she'd said that there was one line that she thought was really funny, and I knew it would be, we're burglars. We're burgling your turps. It's just little stuff like that. It's like when it crosses over into the Adventure Time style of comedy, where it's, I think it's genuinely properly hilarious, but maybe isn't for everyone. But it doesn't always hit those notes. It just stays at like a really mild level.
I'm in agreement with you that the pumpkin episode was the strongest one. I think the sense of weirdness and creepiness, it carried through. It was the most coherent of all the incoherence, you know, in the series. And yeah, I did enjoy that more than others, but that's not to say that I'd be like, you know, going out and recommending it. It was my whole experience for the series as an, you know, in its entirety was just a kind of sense of, why am I watching this? And I wish I had, like, you know, another idea for the podcast.
That's such a shame. I mean, I think Whispers episode is really good. You didn't like that?
No,
which one?
I really don't.
Anti Whispers, the ringing of the bell.
I did really like that. Yeah,
it's a kind of creepy drawing, but like I said, I said to Jack when you were away that it's not my style of entertainment. I don't really choose to watch much animation stuff, and there's not many like animated films that I wouldn't watch with kids that I can think that I'd actually want to watch that like by myself for entertainment, you know. I think it's pretty much, I'd watch Akira. But outside of that, it's just not my thing, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Jack, you were saying that you agreed that the ringing of the bell was strong. Did you also like the pumpkin episode, or were there any other episodes that you thought were particularly strong?
I liked a lot of portions of a lot of episodes. I thought those two episodes were great, despite the fact that I wasn't too keen on the entry into the other world. I liked the scene back in real life where he's just getting really hung up on, you know, talking to that girl. I love the line when he comes up behind her in a party when she's saying to her friend, like, yeah, I wouldn't be a ballerina, but my parents really want me to be a wrestler. And just how I laughed out loud at that, but it did strike my humor chords a lot more. I just liked, even the episodes I didn't like, the tone of the show was enough to carry me. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but I really enjoyed the music. And I hate musicals. And I don't like comedy music. So it doesn't really make sense that I'd like the music in this. I wouldn't put it on my phone and listen to it on the way to work. But I just thought it was sweet and it fitted and it worked for me. And a song
about... I love the music too. I mean, I think even like the daft little songs like Potatoes and Molasses and stuff like that is a really sweet song. And it's, I think a lot of it's, I think the songwriting is consistently very strong in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's that's not something I knew going in. That would be really, I mean, I think it was at least one song every episode. And I really liked the Highwayman song, things like that. What else? I liked a lot of the voice acting. I thought a lot of the voice acting was excellent. That's something Kimmy and I talk about a lot for different reasons. But so the woodsman with the lamp, was that Christopher Lloyd?
Yeah.
He did a great job. It was really, really cool. I just really enjoyed it all. All those elements came together. And, you know, I remember individual jokes and I remember individual characters and I remember voices. My want for it, and as usual, when I have my cake and eat it, is I want to cut it up, re-edit it, and make it into a much shorter but fluid film.
Yeah, I can see that too. I think I'm surprised that you two had such a negative reaction when you just went to what the actual setup to the story was. And I agree totally that the actual mechanic for getting them over the wall and into this world is a little bit, I think there's
hackneyed.
There's more room for a more interesting idea at its core. But I think I was really welcoming of the kind of real worldness of the film after so much of the program, after so much trippiness for the first 7 episodes or something like that. Mm. Like, it felt really refreshing, like a real palate cleanser once they were actually, you know, it was Halloween night and they were dressed up and it was explaining things. I was actually quite fond of that. But I would like to see it as like a feature length film. I think it would have, I mean, it clearly draws influences from feature films, whether that's Night of the Hunter, or clearly there's a massive Studio Ghibli influence that I'm not even a big particularly knowledgeable about Miyazaki or anything like that, but clearly, like, see, just in terms of the shapes of characters and stuff like that, like, it's undeniable that these are clearly, there's things in Spirited Away that I'm looking at going, well, this is clearly meant to be that.
I think, like, it's more heavily influenced by what's currently going on in the early art scene. Now, we're going to stop two sentences into this because it's something you have no relation to and our viewers have no interest in. But I'm looking at it and thinking that's influenced by Andy Kohi, that's influenced by Audrey Kawasaki. So there's lots of things that really, really leans on that are contemporary art and going on in LA. Now, this guy comes from Silver Lake in LA, so it wouldn't surprise me if he was part of that. I've just never seen his name attached to any gallery exhibitions. Sure. So Studio Ghibli, I wasn't seeing as much, but it's maybe because I was being drawn to what I see as more contemporary influences immediately around him.
I think... For 10 episodes, I mean, the only time I got a genuine sense of emotion was the kind of unfortunate discovery that the woodsman has, that, you know, that he's been misled, and that, you know, he's been, you know, kind of an unknowing co-conspirator in the beast's actions and not been, you know, saving anything. You know, they got some. I felt bad for him there, but that's just me being, like, you know, a sentimental dad, just like, you know, oh no, baby, you know. But that was probably like the only part where I felt like some honest connection in terms of the emotion that was portrayed in it. But yeah, on the whole, it felt kind of superficial and just this isn't me. Whoever they're putting this out for. It's not for me. You know.
Did you like the mythology of it?
I think when you go into, you know, a fairy tale aspect, it can either be, well, we're riffing on classics, or it can be we're just not bothering to imagine much ourselves anyway, and just steal from other stories, and I felt the whole thing was a bit thin. It wasn't well fleshed out. There wasn't much plot there. It was just, here's some odd stuff, here's some inexplicable things. And I mean, all it is, you know, a couple of kids get lost, and you know, they go through some, you know, dilemmas and tribulations to find a greater family relationship. It's not a particularly, you know, imaginative setting, and I don't think the mechanics of this imaginary world are explained in enough detail to really say it has mythology. It's all just layers of artifice that you can choose to accept or not, but they don't actually matter in the end, because it's all undercut by the bump on the head plot device at the end.
I think people like this film, and people love this series, by the way. I'm seeing it appear on like best animations ever lists already, things like that. And that might fade over time, but all the same, I think people like this as much because of the tone of it, the visual style, and its general sense of whimsy and comedy. And I think it kind of captured the zeitgeist of where animation's going on television. I don't know if animation will go this way on film, but this is where it is on television right now. And that, you said yourself, the demographic's weird. What I think the appeal of it is for adults is it's just a sense of comfort. It's just something that's comforting. It's easy to watch, but it's off kilter and weird enough that it still gives you a wry smile. And that's how I read into it.
I'm on the other side of the fence. You know, I don't want to be like, you know, I'm a harsh, like, judgmental person who thinks, you know, you're lesser for enjoying animation, but I kind of do. I don't wow. want to. I don't think that's fair. I don't think it's reasonable. But I don't really get it. I think it's just a kind of, it's just like comfort food. It's just this is just someone, you know, eating like 12 packs of Watsits.
Yeah, whoa. Sure. I mean, I don't know that that's necessarily my instinct when it comes to animation. I don't know. It's fun. It's enjoyable. I had a lot of, you know, fun watching it, but I think there's enough edge in it to kind of, I mean, it's a palatable edge, I'll give you that, where it's sort of visceral, and you know, you feel something when you see like the scarier moments, and it doesn't necessarily provoke anything that wouldn't be satisfying inside you. But like, I don't know that I can necessarily dispute your point.
I hear what you're saying, but
I could compare that to all television.
I've seen you know, plenty of films and even some animated stuff where I've felt a sense of actual like peril or danger. I just didn't get that from this at all. I thought it would all just be, you know, played off with kind of silly humour, and it would work out conveniently in the end anyway. I mean, it's, if you want, you know, dark animation, then, you know, it's like the more mainstream, the darker. Disney's darker than this, you know? I mean, If you want dark, then you know, have, you know,
Pinocchio,
you know, Scar murder his brother and stuff like that, you know.
But I actually think there's something to be said about its numbingness, about the fact that it doesn't necessarily go for any literal sense of jeopardy. Because I agree that you don't really feel any sense of jeopardy or any stakes or anything. That it feels like it's all going to work out okay. But by the same token, it's kind of like a bad dream where, in a bad dream, you're not necessarily fearing for your life. It's just the fact that things are just a wee bit off kilter, that, you know, the world just isn't quite the way it should be, and that's kind of disquieting. And for me, that was kind of the tone that ran through the whole show. Like, you're never quite sure exactly on what foot you stand, and like, some animals talk, some animals are mute, some animals talk but in their native tongue. So you could have, like, you know, Beatrice, obviously, the horse can talk. You could have the turkeys in the pumpkin episode that just kind of lay flop down at a table, then lift their head up and look at you, then flop back down. Or you've got the frogs on the boat that just kind of gribbit but don't communicate in any way that can be discernible. There's just kind of, you're never quite sure where you are or exactly what's going on. You're kind of just at the mercy of the narrative that's propelling you on this journey. And to me, that kind of has its own appeal and it's kind of interesting.
Propelling's a strong word. This journey.
Ambling's probably fair enough. It's your own propulsion that's driving you through the episodes. But
it's inertia. There's no propulsion.
I mean, I would agree with that. But I was
maybe the most laid-back quest film or, you know, quest story I've seen in quite some time.
Whoa. Yeah, but at the same time, it has a dreamy, trippy quality that I don't think is really deniable. Like, it feels as if you've just woken up somewhere and you're trying to make sense of something in the best way that you can, and if that means just wandering about trying to get your bearings, if you're an inadequate hero like Wirt and Gregar, then I think it kind of makes sense for it to feel a little bit wandery and not quite as, you know, driven narratively as some other things may be.
Yeah, not totally.
Yeah.
What kind of animation are you drawn to in any way, Martin?
That's the thing. I mean, it's not something that I really look to get involved in. You know, I pretty much see it as, you know, a kid's thing with minimal exceptions to that, you know. I mean, I never got into to like the kind of manga craze in when I was in high school. There were some kids that were into that, but then I saw Akira, and then, you know, someone gets me to watch like Urutsuka Doji, and you're screw you, no. this ain't cool. I'm not on board.
What about Pixar? Like, in recent years, are you into?
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, that's like, that's kid stuff that, you know, you can enjoy as an adult. They're fun movies. I don't have an issue with that, but I just with things like that, I can really enjoy it, but I don't really think of them as mine, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's,
I think as far as like animated things that I care about, you're really talking about Akira and Transformers the Animated Movie from 86.
Yeah,
I love that movie, and that's a cold-hearted film, you know. If you're going to kill Optimus Prime in like the first like 15-20 minutes, it's like you've just blown apart my universe as a 7-year-old.
Yeah, I think maybe on some level there's maybe just a failure to communicate in terms of like the, I don't feel that way about animation. Like, I do find it easy to claim ownership of animation in terms of its style and stuff like that. So when I went back recently and started rewatching the Disney stuff, like Lady and the Tramp and Bambi and Dumbo and all that, it was never as if I felt as if they were lesser just because they were animated. It just kind of, it just made a sense to me. And I can't really, I mean, the fact that you don't, I can't see any way of compelling you. It must be the way that people feel when I say that anime just makes me feel sick when I look at it, that there's no value that I can really, there is value that I can get from it, but it's so much work to dig through to get to it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I enjoy the craft of like the sort of Disney classics, the way that it's paced so well. I mean, I can't think of many better paced films than The Lion King.
Yeah.
In terms of how it builds that structure of, you know, introductory, like, you know, comfort and everything's okay, into threat and then into disaster and then into recovery and then facing threat and triumph. It flows so well. Yeah. Like, every time you have, you know, a bit that's pushing at the edges of what kids are used to in the stuff they watch, then you have comic relief kind of like, you know, coming in just to kind of smooth out the edges. I think that kind of aspect of it's masterful.
See, this is interesting because you just said they're pushing the edges of what kids would be like able to consume, and like I think that could bring us back into this series where, like, particularly I'm thinking of the Anti-Whispers episodes, and probably the Pumpkin episode as well, where you're watching it thinking, this, I mean, the only child that I have any kind of, you both have children, but regular kind of dealings with is Emma's niece, Nicole. She's maybe five or six at the moment. And I don't think she could cope with this show. Like, I know her sensibilities, and I think if I sat her down to watch the Anti-Whispers episode, that it would be pretty traumatic for her. I think it's a programme that sort of... It definitely pushes visceral boundaries of what a kid's show is capable of showing. And it's really unnerving.
It's not really meant to be a kid's show, is it?
Is it?
You know?
I don't know.
Cartoon Network is a kind of netherland. It's not supposed to be a children's network. It's animation. The same way that... You're not going to tell me that Adventure Time is a kids' TV show, are you?
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I know kids watch it, but...
I'm not sure they get a lot of it.
Yeah, it's for 20-somethings.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just that... I think that's Martin was saying that he's just not part of that demographic. I'm sorry to draw the curtain back here, but the part you're going to cut later when you go to the bathroom, Martin was saying that he just doesn't get it. He's just not part of him. I'm not as ardently in that camp. I'll watch it to experience it, and I might get some enjoyment out of it. But I'm definitely not in the camp where I don't feel that I have any ownership over my experience with animation. I think it's a lesser, and I think I mean, you mentioned anime earlier. There's so much shite anime. We've done a whole episode on this, so I'm not going to go back to it. But I did want to pitch an episode to you on atypical anime or French animation or something like that. But I'm reluctant to now. I don't want to, like, give you, like, a ton of shit to watch you're going to resent me for.
Well, no, I mean, we've actually... Jack and I actually had a conversation once about... What was the programme?
I'd be more interested in that. I mean, I've got a DVD set of like Polish animation classics that I'd never like bothered watching.
Yeah.
They just it happened onto a hard drive of mine, and another thing called like The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, which I saw a moment of, and it looked beautiful. And then if it looks beautiful, then I'm okay to watch it. I thought that, you know, Over the Garden Wall was kind of halfway there, and, like, you know, the scenery is exceptional, but the rest was workaday.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was... Don't go on, Jack.
The conversation we had previously was about a series of film by René, and no idea pronouncing the name, René Laloux, I think, Time Masters, the Savage Planet?
That's the one.
Fantastic Planet, Le Planet Savage, yeah. Just how trippy and weird his stuff is. I know you've seen The Fantastic Planet, Martin. I mean, I know that appeals to you. You've mentioned you enjoy that before.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of cool. I just think for animation, it doesn't speak to my heart, you know? It doesn't tend to inspire me or, like, create awe in me. I rarely see things and think that that's been done perfectly, and I could comfortably watch this, like, 15 times. I mean, I gravitate more towards kind of, like, epic landscape and that kind of thing. I mean, I could quite happily sit down, like, you know, every evening and watch Ride the High Country and just be completely content with that. It's like, that's the movie I'm going to watch.
Mm.
That's the movie that I will watch every evening of my life until I die. And I will enter my house justified.
I certainly don't think you're alone. I mean, I was talking to someone at work the other day about... I've actually made plans 3 times now to go and see Big Hero 6, and they've all fallen through. But tomorrow, I will see Big Hero 6, and I'm not cancelling that plan for anything. Like, if my dad...
I don't even know what it is.
Oh, right. It's the new Disney one. Mm-hmm. It's like a...
It's a Marvel, I think it's, Disney, yeah, they made it in conjunction with Marvel. Music, yeah.
Did you see it, Jack?
No, I saw clips from it, and the clips made me laugh. So,
Yeah,
I want to see.
I'm looking
for that
forward
reason.
To seeing it. But this, the bloke that I was talking to was saying that like he can't imagine going to the cinema and watching an animation. Like he's got three daughters, and he was saying, well, like he would go with his daughters to watch something, but for his own pleasure, like it just wouldn't appeal to him. And it never really occurred to me before, but I guess it's just the spectacle of animation and the spectacle of film were never something that I distinguished. Like, it's only when it's particularly gaudy to me, like anime, that I sort of, or not gaudy necessarily, but just ugly and static and obviously artificial, that it kind of bothers me. But in terms of like traditional animation and CG and stop motion, they fall into one language for me, the same thing as cinema.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it follows on because I was never a comic book reader. It's not a format that really appealed to me. It doesn't get me going. You know?
Yeah,
I feel like throwing down the gauntlet and at least trying to have you watch two or three, but I'm going to have to put a lot of research into it if you don't want to kill me afterwards.
Like you say, as far as like choosing to go to watch like an animation film, I mean, the notion that I would do that, like, you know, in like, you know, 3 years' time without it just being, you know, like a family thing, is just anathema to me. I mean, we don't tend to watch loads of TV. I try and keep it to like, you know, a couple hours in the mornings, like on my days off, to give me some time to become human again. And then you're like, okay, got to like disengage from the TV and like, you know, be human beings and try and do some stuff. But there's times when I really appreciate, like, you know, they're kind of like, you know, throwing a bone to the adults to, you know, keep, you know, just keep you from like wanting to just smash the TV up. Because sometimes like kids' animation can just be like just soul destroying stuff. I think the one that I'm more favourable to just now is on CBeebies, and it's called Hey Dougie. And Dougie's a dog, and Dougie's a kind of scout leader for all these other little animals, like some crocodile and an elephant and stuff like that. And they go and they go for their like their badge. You know Alexander Armstrong from Armstrong and Miller and, you know, Pointless and stuff.
Yeah, I know him from Pointless more than anything.
Well, he's the narrator for it. And yeah, it's like a nice, like wholesome, short kids show. It looks nice. The animation's like really clean and bright, and you know, it's all quite simplistic and bold colours. And then in the midst of it, when you've got, you know, little animal kids trying to get their omelette badge, they go into a hen house, and in the hen house are like three hens sitting watching TV. And they're watching like a hen soap opera on TV, and there's just this like, you know, Spanish hen doctor, and they're like, "Te amo."
See, I think this is
and I was like, "Oh, that's brilliant, thank you."
This is where the appeal of animation lies, though. It's both in the attention to detail and the fact that it has the opportunity to be irreverent that you wouldn't really get in any other media. Like, and the effort that it would take to cast, shoot, and, you know, assemble that sort of thing in a live action just wouldn't be worth the joke that they're making. But because they're animators, they're presumably geeky, talented artists.
I think, they just, I mean, when it works, and I don't object to it, but I didn't feel like anything really like that, apart from that, like, one joke we talked about. I mean, but even, like, a visual joke, I didn't like much of the physical comedy or slapstick that was in Over the Garden Wall. But in Hey Dougie, there's a rainy day, and when he steps outside, all, like, the rain coming down is just like interrupted parallel vertical lines.
Yeah.
And it's all really like beautiful and even and, you know, sort of organised rain. And he steps outside and it's windy, and all the lines switch from being like vertical to horizontal.
Yeah.
It's just like really dynamic, like, you know, stark blue lines, you know, going down, and then it goes whoosh the other way, and it's a really like clean visual effect, and I really appreciated it. So, you know, my tip, if you're looking for something to enjoy with a 2 or 3 year old child, is watch Hey Dougie. Well, I don't hate all animation, it's just, it's not mine, you know.
I I like the idea and the craft behind animation, not just in the visual aspect of it, but in the restrictions it provides and the achievements you get through those restrictions. With a film, and you're talking before about the trouble of going things, if a scene doesn't work, you can reshoot it. But then if you're making an animation, you better get that scene fucking right. Because that is going to be months of work just to reanimate something. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I'm not saying that Over the Garden Wall is a sterling example where every scene works, but where you get mastercrafts of them, and they do tend to be either Japanese or American, those are the ones I appreciate the most, where that's true, where, wow, that was tremendous, that was really well-paced scene. I, you know, I wonder how long they thought about where, you know, the quote-unquote camera should be to capture that, you know, and I get a lot out of that, of it.
Yeah, see, it's weird that, like, I feel as though animation doesn't really push the boundaries of the fact that they have a quote-unquote camera as opposed to a real camera. Like, surely... I mean, it's restricted by the fact that you're watching it on a television or within a window, but surely there should be another way to present the format in a way that excludes the need for it to be captured by an imaginary camera. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like animation could be more adventurous than it actually is if it just looks at its own form and then starts to be conceptual about it. And I haven't given enough thought to come up with an interesting solution or an interesting alternative to the pretend camera that they don't need to have. But it feels as though, like, the right creative mind could get there and then think, you know, why are we pretending that we have a camera filming this? Why don't we just, you know, do something completely abstract and completely different?
And they have done that before, but no one wants to see those films. They're art school films. They last about 20 minutes. They don't even involve people. It's just, I mean, okay, most short animations you'll see, and this is a recurrent theme, a short animation anything from 1 to about 4 or 5 minutes will animate itself in such a way to appear to have one consecutive shot. And that's, I could pull up right now in Letterboxd a dozen examples of that short movies and post them. But it's something that's recurrent, and it seems to be a challenge where animators take it upon themselves to have a camera which can not only move through scenes, but move into a colour and pan round, and what would then be one object in one scene is just by virtue of a colour fade and a pan is now something completely different. You know, you're somewhere else within an environment. So that happens a lot. Or they'll just take something and they'll warp it until it's something else and keep warping it until it's something else. So that's not unusual. It's just that how do you make a narrative out of that?
Yeah, true.
Okay.
I know, but it just routinely frustrates me that it feels like animation is trying to ape the restrictions that it doesn't need to abide. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't need to pretend that it's restricted by the same things that motion pictures are. So the fact that it continues to do so, it always seems strange to me that it hasn't thought about exploring avenues that are just, you know, that cinema's incapable of. It probably would even make a more firm place for itself in the cinematic landscape if it decided to ignore what cinema has to be restricted by.
Yeah, but it's going to be pretty tough to get people to disengage from the kind of visual grammar that you just,
that's
you
true.
Know, you build up just watching, you know, TV and movies, you know, through your life, and to get someone to like step outside that to create something is one thing, but to get, you know, several hundred thousand or million people, you know, actually appreciating that they've done that and not being like, the fuck is this?
Yeah,
that, yeah, it's a tough thing to ask, but it's, you know, I understand the impulse.
I'll tell you what, somewhere down the line, and probably not even this year, but I'm going to research and pitch an animated movie episode. I'll keep it to no more than 3 movies. I'll keep each movie to under 90 minutes, but I'll also try and do things that aren't typical. Martin, you said like you like really beautiful landscapes and things like that, so background details important for you? I've got 2 or 3 I can think of recommending. I'm just really cautious. I don't want to waste your time, but there is stuff that's worth seeing. How do you feel about stop motion animation? I'm just asking you a question.
I bet you love it.
I, I don't really have many positive experiences with it.
Okay, well, we won't touch that then. We won't touch that.
Yeah. That's... I mean, short of your like, kind of Wallace and Gromit and, you know, that kind of stuff, it's not something that I'm... I feel that I'm missing out on too strongly.
All right, I'll drop it there. Did you have anything more to say, or did you want to wrap this up?
Well, do you know, I was actually curious about some of the weaker episodes, like... I was just having a look because Martin's actually got a list here of some of the episodes, and I would say like the weaker ones are actually episode one, in which I think the big thrust is the woodsman and the big beasts. Dog monster thing, yeah, which I wasn't particularly interested in. I was a bit dubious of the show after watching that. I wasn't too fond of the schoolyard episode, but again, really good songs. There's a lot to like about it, but just in terms of like. In terms of the global look at the whole show, it maybe isn't the strongest episode. Same with the haunted house episode, and I mean the one where Greg ends up in the clouds with all the other or with like all the inanimate angel type characters.
Oh, you didn't like that?
I don't know that I didn't like it. I don't really know what to make of it. Like, it takes its trippiness to a different level where it's not so much dark. It's just a bit... Tonally, it doesn't seem to mesh with the rest of the show. But... Yeah, and for that reason, I forgot that it actually existed until I just saw it there.
That's a ringing endorsement of it, isn't it?
I mean, did you think that it felt appropriate within the context of the show?
It's just like his little fervent imagination, the younger of the two siblings, going crazy. I mean, you know, he's been told he's a leader now, so he's just imagined himself in like a 1930s animation style heaven. The jokes worked for me, the comedy worked. I mean, it was clearly a tribute to an era of animation, but what got me most is the hook at the end where he's talking to the, you know, the queen of Cloudland, or the sort of angelic figure in his head, and comes back to reality, and he's talking to the beast, you know, voiced by a really efficient James Earl Jones impersonator who can also sing opera. That was creepy, really effectively creepy.
I think the beast is like a pretty creepily conceived character as well. Like, I'm not gonna lie, like this is pretty embarrassing, but last night in bed, like as I'm wont to do. Totally harassed myself. Like, I just lay there. Emma had opened up the door because I think she'd suspected that the night was going to be pretty warm. And laying there in bed with the door open where I can look into my hallway and just see like the corner before my stairs. And I was just thinking, when I open my eyes and look into that corridor, the beast shall be stood there. I think that the conception of the beast itself, because it was funny, because I do think it's funny that I routinely torment myself about stuff like this. And I was actually, because me and my mate have a thing about this, that I seem to lack a control over the part of my brain that doesn't want to terrify me.
Yeah.
So I said to him, do you want to hear the latest one? And I said, like, I was describing this show, and I was like, just to give you an idea of what this show looks like, just look at this. And it was like a picture of Wart and Greg. But I think what it does is it sets a tone, and within that tone, the darkness of a character like the Beast is kind of unnerving. Mm-hmm. So it's not a massive extrapolation to take that outside of that context and say... that, you know, in the context of my life, the Beast would be pretty scary if I ever encountered him. You know, I have to walk through the woods tonight to get home. And I guarantee you that my thoughts will range from, you name it. I'll be thinking that it's going to get me.
Hopefully you don't fall into a pumpkin grave or something like that.
I pray to God. But yeah, there's a chance that'll be edited out because it is massively embarrassing that this show plagued me.
Pretty humiliating for a person of your age. So.
Okay. Well, shall we wrap it up?
Dear Sounds God, good yes. to me.
Okay. Thank you for watching The Film Interrupted. Until next time.
It's been a pleasure.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to Film Interrupted. If you want to contact us, we can be reached at Film Interrupted on Gmail, Tumblr, Facebook, and of course iTunes. If you'd like to contact us on Letterboxd, I can be found under TechnoSnob303, Martin under Martino Heat, and Nick under Nick Ede. Nice handle, Nick.